Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A show for history buffs this hour. We're going to talk this hour about a time capsule from Samuel Adams left in Boston back in the 1700s. It apparently does not include any bottles of beer. And we remember the truce 100 years ago, Christmas 1914, at the start of World War I, something soldiers did all on their own and something that lives in historical memory as vividly today as any of the official battles or the armistice from that war. We'll also look at the traditional dock workers on the West Coast and how they fear what machines might do to jobs that have been stable for decades. But we begin in Australia in very much the present moment. As you've heard, a hostage situation ends violently in Sydney, Australia, that took the focus of the world media for more than 16 hours. A Lindt chocolate shop in Sydney, where a Muslim gunman claiming to have bombs took hostages, made demands, was involved in negotiations with the authorities, and then police moved in. This from Nine News in Australia.
They look to be at the ready, those, and they're going in. And there is gunfire. You can hear all of the heavily armed police going in right now.
Not long after that exchange and the broadcast of those pictures on Australian media, at 2:45 local time, the New South Wales police tweeted, "Sydney siege is over. There have been casualties. There was a bomb sweep to secure the area, and now the people of Australia are left with questions." With us now, Michelle Innes, reporter for our partner, The New York Times, in Sydney. Michelle, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
And let's just take everyone through the sort of ending of this siege. The early morning hours, we're speaking of the negotiations that were taking place, and then all of a sudden, things really began to change. What are you reporting?
Okay, yes, we saw five, possibly six hostages run out of the Lindt Chocolate Cafe, which is at the top of Martin Place in Sydney. And very quickly after they ran out, and without warning, there was sudden live rounds, but definitely very loud noises and flashes of light lighting up the front of the Lindt Cafe. And then police stormed into the building. There was smoke, alarms went off. It was very dramatic and very sudden.
In the course of the negotiations that took place in the early hours of the morning, the identity of the man believed to be the hostage taker became public, and he turned out to be a fairly familiar individual to reporters and others in Australia.
That's right. He is known to police. Police were reluctant to confirm his identity, but he has been named in the local media as Mon Haron Monis, an Iranian who's aged about 50. He has a criminal record for various offences, including one for which involved him aiding or abetting the murder of his former wife. He was also on charges relating to having written poison pen letters to the family of Australian servicemen who died in service overseas.
So it's not really known at this point, even though Australia is, you know, part of the coalition in Afghanistan and Iraq and has been targeted in the war on terror. It's not clear if this incident is purely a criminal matter in Sydney or lives in some sort of netherworld between a crackpot shooting incident and something that actually does involve a conspiracy, a jihadist conspiracy, yes?
That's correct. It's police have not confirmed whether he was just acting alone or whether he's part of a larger network, which in a way he exhibited a black flag with white Arabic script on it, made hostages hold that up to the window very early on in the siege, and this is why police or why media initially thought that he was linked to a terrorist organisation. But that hasn't been confirmed, and in fact, this man's former lawyer has said that he believes he was acting alone, that he was passionate about his causes, and that he was so passionate that he was deluded, in fact.
And indeed, sometime in the last 24 hours, something caused him to cross over from delusions into actual actions here. Describe just how much this pushed the buttons and fears of people in Sydney during the course of your reporting, Michelle?
The city remained relatively calm. I think police dealt with the situation very quickly by shutting down the central business district. The cafe itself in Martin Place, Martin Place is a major pedestrian thoroughfare, and it's the place where the country's central bank, the Reserve Bank of Australia, is located there. Three major banks have big offices in Martin Place. State Parliament's around the corner. The Opera House is within walking distance. So it's a very central part of Sydney. And the cafe itself is somewhere that both locals stop at for their morning coffee or their hot chocolate, and also it's a draw card for tourists. So it's summer here, and we have summer school holidays running at the moment. So it would have been busy. But despite that, police managed to get people out of the area quickly. They managed to evacuate people out of the buildings. Even from the floors above the Lindt Cafe, people were seen climbing down ladders. I saw a baby being handed out of a building. The transport system, the train system was shut down, but only temporarily. Traffic on the Sydney Harbour Bridge was shut. But it didn't seem to create chaos. People were patient. They understood what was happening. And the police were able to get on with their job, which was basically around negotiating with this man over the release of those hostages.
And given the scenarios that could have transpired here, this would appear to represent one of the more positive scenarios of the outcome.
Absolutely. Local media are saying two people have been killed, which is a terrible outcome. But on the plus side, if there is one, we did see many, you know, maybe 10 hostages walk out of the building, run out of the building. And although it's been a terrible experience for them, they've come out physically unharmed. There's been no tragic mass casualties. So in that sense, it's you know, been handled efficiently, or as efficiently as it could have been.
Looking once again at the images, this would seem to be unprecedented in Sydney, even if it was relatively on the plus side. I mean, there haven't been these kind of attacks in Australia proper.
No, that's right. I think people, Australians, would have found this shocking today. They would have been very alarmed to turn on their TVs and see that in their sunny city in the middle of summer, when people are thinking about Christmas and their families, their loved ones, to see this happen in the centre of the city would have been shocking. It doesn't happen often. There have been some incidents where police have arrested and charged people. Counter-terrorism operations have taken place. But as far as terrorist attacks on our own soil, they're few and far between. And we also don't have a lot of people with firearms in Australia. So it's unusual for even somebody in our city to be walking around the city with a firearm.
Michelle Innes is a reporter for the New York Times in Sydney, Australia. Thanks so much, Michelle.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Come on, SKL, get it up. All right, take it away.
One of the most famous Hollywood movies, On the Waterfront, is about the big East Coast ports of another era, where big union men move huge crates of goods from ships docking from all over the world.
I want to talk.
Get away from me, will you? All right, take it up.
Today, the port system in the United States is largely dominated by mechanized containers moving iPads, sweaters, socks, and food in those boxes you see everywhere. And the East Coast ports long ago ceded domination of the container system to the West Coast, with the ports of L.A. and Long Beach in California on the shores of Hollywood, right at the top of the heap.
Acres and just acres and containers as far as you can see until you see the ocean. It's a whole industry. And so there are about 12 to 20 different companies, different terminal operators like Evergreen and Maersk and those names that you're familiar with existing in this one location. It's like if all the automobile companies, if, you know, GM and Toyota all were in the same exact spot. It's so complicated. Like, it's just there's so many little details and facets and different kinds of jobs that it felt like this kind of never-ending process to kind of, you know, peel it back.
Independent producer Lou Olkowski followed the ins and outs of the ports of L.A. and Long Beach for more than a year. She documented this world for Cargoland, a series produced in collaboration with KCRW's Independent Producer Project. Today and tomorrow, we focus on the workers themselves and the incredible, powerful union that controls these two ports.
Well, the union in the L.A. Long Beach area, it's very powerful. It's the hub of the entire ILWU, which is the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. And there is something patriarchal and old-fashioned. It feels like 1950s. It does feel like it's from another time there. And these jobs have allowed them to hold on to a culture where you can have a single breadwinner and fully support your family.
And their fate is bound up in the union in terms of, seniority and, the level of retirement. Here's Sasha Karlik, who's one of the workers in L.A. and Long Beach.
You know, like so many of us are in a catch-22. You know, I've invested 10 years of my prime. You know, I'm not getting younger. And now if I walk out and just, like, stop taking every job I can possibly get to, then almost guaranteed I won't get in the union.
What is Sasha talking about there, that struggle that sounds so arduous?
Well, Sasha is what they call a casual worker, which basically means he does longshore work, but he works and does the work that's left over every day. So, like many of us, we hear in the news how, you know, those guys, those longshoremen, make these incredible salaries. They can make six-figure salaries and have these, you know, Cadillac health plans and these great pensions, and they do. But to get into the union has always been difficult. You're either born into it. It used to be that you were born into it. If your father was in the union, you could be invited into the union. But at some point, it was decided that that was nepotism, and it went against good hiring practice. And now, the way to get into the union is to become what they call a casual worker. And what that is it's a freelancer, except it's this very arduous process where every day on the morning shift and in the overnight shift, you have to call in to see if there's work for you, to see if the union longshore members took it, or if there's leftover work. And if there's leftover work, it can be yours if you're the right spot in line. And so what that means is that for someone like Sasha, he might go down to this casual hiring hall where they give out the jobs, you know, twice a day for 2 or 3, 4 days a week before he gets a job, before it's his turn in line, before there's extra work that they need the casuals to do.
If you're willing to camp out on the front porch of the palace and greedily take every crumb we throw at you for 2, 4, 6, 10, 12 years, we'll invite you in to have a permanent seat at the banquet eventually. But till then, it's like you got no status, you're a third class citizen, and that's kind of what it is being a casual.
Wow.
He's been doing this for over 10 years. You know, it's over 10 years of showing up. And sometimes you get a job and sometimes you don't. And you show up again. And, to get into the union, the way it works is those casuals with the most hours get in first. So you really want to be down at that hall. You really want to grab every job that you can, because if not, then other casuals are going to get ahead of you in line to get into the union. So even though it's miserable and, you know, certainly during the recession, these guys weren't working at all. There may be a job once a month at that point, but they had to keep kind of going down and being in tune with it, because if they miss that job, someone could get in front of them in line.
And you've experienced in this whole, you know, series the scale and the hugeness of the ports, and yet you're never able to forget, or at least certainly the workers there, what happens and what it's like when it shuts down. Here's John McLaurin, who is president of the Pacific Merchant Shipping Association.
The worldwide economy had tanked. Nobody was buying anything. Nobody was shipping anything. And so ships were laid up and not going anywhere. It was an incredible sight to see. You would see dozens upon hundreds, really, around Singapore and Scotland and other areas around the world, because there was just no volume.
No money to finance cargo, to finance movement. The ships came to a halt. How fearful were all those folks of what happened there in 2008, 2009?
Well, I think for this industry, I think this was just the most brutal wake-up call. I mean, the industry is already, as I explained, really competitive. You know, cargo flows like water. It's always going to find the cheap, most inexpensive route. And ports are always kind of jockeying, like even the port of LA and Long Beach. You know, they steal a customer here, they bring it back here. So it's fiercely competitive. But once the recession hit, every container mattered so much more, and they got even more competitive than they ever had been.
Lou Olkowski is an independent producer of Cargo Land, a collaboration with KCRW. She's now a producer and reporter at WGBH. We'll continue our conversation about the ports of LA and Long Beach and the threat of automation in shipping on tomorrow's program.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Here's some history. As Massachusetts laid the foundation for its state house in 1795, Governor Samuel Adams, Paul Revere, and William Scola decided to leave a token of their time for us residents of the future. They enclosed a time capsule, a strongbox, in a cornerstone of the state house, where it was recovered by the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston last week. Joining me now is fellow resident of the future, now the present, Massachusetts Secretary of State William Galvin, who was on hand as the capsule was unearthed. Welcome.
It's good to be with you.
And as residents of the future, now the present, what was it like to see this unearthing? I guess it had been known to be there from earlier documents?
We were aware of its presence, not just because there were very detailed notes of its original entombment in 1795, but when it was subsequently removed because of construction in 1855, it was very ceremoniously returned with some new additions from 1855. And it had stayed since 1855 in the cornerstone.
Do we know if anybody peeked in the box back in 1855?
Well, yeah, they did. In fact, the original box, the 1795 box, was apparently animal hide and had deteriorated. So they took all the artifacts from 1795, and they replaced them in a metal box, which is what we recovered the other day. And they added some of their own from 1855, and they put an additional inscription reciting once again what they had done in 1855, and we believe all of that is in the box. The biggest question that now remains is what's the condition of the contents of the box. Unfortunately, we also have notes that in 1855 they washed some of the coins in acid, which we're concerned might have had some adverse effect on the condition of the coins, but we'll, over the next few days, be determining exactly their condition and where we go from here.
Now, you mentioned that it's going to be x-rayed, or it has been x-rayed, and
yes,
you've got some idea, any rumors of what the condition is of the coins?
We're going to have a consultation with all the curators to make sure that, right now, our main concern, the time capsule itself is actually relatively small. I was surprised. It's almost as if it were a metal book. And we know it was very tightly sealed and soldered. So we have to be very careful if we do open it, how it's to be opened to make sure there's no damage to the contents. And then we're going to have to decide, it's definitely going back. That's not a decision. Of course, it's going back. The question is, if we open it and we take out the contents, will we add any more? That remains to be decided. But sometime in the next few months, it'll be restored as the construction progresses.
What do you put in it? You know, an iPad
well,
or something?
Suggested in light of the presence of Sam Adams at the first incarnation of it, maybe we should now put a bottle of Sam Adams. After all, who would have believed, or certainly Sam wouldn't have believed, that he'd have a beer named after him in 2015 when this will probably be going back. So maybe that's an idea, but I think that might be a little too profane for a cornerstone.
Well, one of the more fun things about being Secretary of State in Massachusetts. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Massachusetts Secretary of State William Galvin was on hand as the time capsule from 1795 was unearthed. It's been unearthed before. It's been x-rayed. We'll find out later this week what's actually in it. So what would you put into a time capsule for the residents of the future?
My name is Dennis. I'm calling from Foxborough, Massachusetts, and I would include a copy of Citizens United decision to show how our Constitution was perverted and how our republic was lost.
One of you from Astoria, Oregon, says my DNA so I could be brought back, like we should bring back King Tut. Your DNA is already in a time capsule. From Omaha, Nebraska, 1, a bottle of open air. 2, a bottle of tap water. 3, an ear of corn before and after our current use of GMOs. 4, a printed copy of the city directory from each decade from when they started. And from Anoka, Minnesota, Cracked Rear View by Hootie and the Blowfish. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. A scratchy voice from the beginning of the last century that can still be heard this holiday season. We're going to consider the 100 years that have passed since a grand heroic moment of absolutely no military significance that occurred at the beginning of what was still not yet named the Great War, or even its later more familiar name, World War I.
Up to mighty London came an Irishman one day. As the streets are paved with gold, sure everyone was gay.
The boys who became the soldiers of the terrible trenches marched off to war 100 years ago when the summer sun shone and the flowers bloomed in August of 1914. By December of that year, the war that the great and small minds alike of Europe predicted would be over by Christmas had revealed itself to be a stalemate across the fields of Belgium and France. And so the boys in the trenches collectively made a decision on Christmas of 1914. They would, on their own, put down their arms. If the war would not be over by Christmas, these young men would pause the conflict for Christmas, German and French and English, together.
We might feel sorry for the soldiers in the trenches in 1914. Many of them were up to waist high in water in freezing cold conditions. But quite a few of the letters say, I wouldn't have exchanged this Christmas for all the Christmases in the world. This was the best Christmas I've ever had.
That's writer Alan Cleaver talking about soldiers who honored a Christmas truce together, perhaps the last moment, the last breath of the gentle manners of 19th century Europe. These soldiers, the last trusting faces in uniform to understand that their commanders and leaders had committed the world to the unending mechanized slaughter that became the 20th century. But for two evenings and a day on December 24th and 25th, 1914, the Christmas truce was made and honored by thousands of soldiers. And we know that from letters the soldiers wrote from the front lines and sent back home. Alan Cleaver has collected hundreds of these letters for an online project he directs called Operation Plum Puddings. Cleaver lives in the small town of Whitehaven in Cumbria, England.
One of the factors that sort of led to the truce was that they were within shouting distance of each other. The trenches were very close in places, and the typical soldier's humour, you know, the Germans would sort of shell the British lines, and then the British would sort of shout out, you know, left a bit or you missed. So I think the soldiers themselves were very surprised when Christmas arrived, and this sort of spontaneous truce broke out along the Western Front.
How's this reflected in the letters, as you've discovered?
Well, I think, first of all, one of the remarkable things that comes across in the letters is the fact that they realised that this was an astounding event. Christmas in the trenches, what a time. Peace on earth, goodwill toward men. On Christmas Eve at 4 p.m, we had orders that unless the enemy advanced, we were not to fire. And the same applied to Christmas Day. Whether the Germans had the same order or not, I don't know, but no shot was fired on either side. In Christmas Eve, we shouted compliments of the season to each other and passed pleasant remarks. We sang the Austrian anthem, and they replied with God Save the King. On Christmas Day, after service in the trenches, we went halfway and we shook hands and we had a fine chat with them. And that's probably a very typical letter in the sense of what happened and the excitement that comes across.
You know, the Great War is this sad metaphor about how Europe was unable to control the inhumanity of the war with these Napoleonic rules and things.
And here this Christmas story tells an opposite tale.
What comes across in most of the letters is a sense of, well, here's what can be achieved. You know, if three warring nations can hold a truce like this at Christmas, then, you know, we could achieve peace. But I think certainly the British soldier said that can only be done if the Germans retreat, if they, you know, go back out of France and out of Belgium and go back to their own country. So there was an understanding that, you know, this was a remarkable event, but it could only be extended into something else if the Germans backed down. But it was a very humane event, and the Pope had tried to organise a truce over Christmas, but the nations had said, no, we're not going to do that. And I think this showed that irrespective of, you know, what might be done on high, the man on the front line can, if he wishes, control events to a certain degree.
Possibly it's also because in the letters you get this hint that the soldiers understood, as we all do now, that at the end of the 19th century, there were these huge forces of industrialization, of kind of globalization, that were suddenly coming into play. And the impulses of a few young men wanting to have Christmas were ultimately not going to matter and get overwhelmed, but we could just take a time out.
I think that there were a number of factors that sort of, that's certainly part of it. I think a number of factors led to that sort of truce. The proximity of the trenches, you know, people being able to talk to each other. But the fact that they shared a common culture, the fact that both of them celebrated Christmas, you know, was crucial to it. Because if they were fighting a nation that didn't celebrate Christmas, it would have been meaningless, of course. And what kicked it all off really was Christmas Eve, because the Germans celebrate Christmas Eve more than they celebrate Christmas Day. So they started singing these songs, and Silent Night is probably the carol most people associate with the truce. But we know from the letters and from war diaries that in fact the British didn't really know Silent Night as a carol in 1914. It was one that was not very well known in Britain. But they talk about, you know, Good King Wenceslas. There were music hall numbers, A Long Way to Tipperary. So it was must have been very moving on Christmas Eve to hear these carols coming over No Man's Land.
And to listen back one century to those voices still resonating, those carols still audible, even today.
Well, I think when you read the letters, they could have been written yesterday. You know, they are talking our language. They're talking with great excitement, and they're talking firsthand. You know, they're saying that this is what's taking place at this very moment. And censorship appears to have been, you know, in its infancy then. And there's a lot of items that are mentioned in the letters, and you think, goodness, you know, how did that get past the censor? But fortunately it did, and it's recorded it. I'm right in saying that it was censored for a while when the truce took place. At first the British were not allowed to talk about it at all. And it was only because American newspapers were going to publish it, who were not subject to our rules, of course, that the British realised, well, we'd better let the cat out of the bag and let this story get out. So it's only thanks to the American press that the British eventually got to hear about this.
Well, it's good to know that we did something right. Alan Cleaver, thanks so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Alan Cleaver is coordinator of Operation Plum Puddings, about the truce 100 years ago, the beginning of the Great War in 1914. Stille Nacht, Silent Night, tomorrow on The Takeaway. A deeper history of this Christmas carol. Soundcheck's John Schaefer on a classic song that's been popular since 1818.
This melody that we take for granted, but when you actually look at it, is so beautiful. It's so simple and simply beautiful.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.